Hello, my name is Veronika Kasova. I live in Edinburgh and I just graduated with a Master's in Psychology of Mental Health. Marion recommended me the Clinical Psychologist Collective when I was networking on LinkedIn, and I must say I love it. It is one of a kind. It's like a window into the lives of people on the path of becoming a psychologist. The stories are unique, honest, and filled with a kind of intangible wisdom only personal storytelling can uncover. A common thread in the stories I valued most was to be compassionate not only with others, but with myself too. Also, not fixating on becoming a psychologist, but enjoying life, growth, and the final results will come as a byproduct. Marianne, thank you for taking the time to collate all the stories. The book is a true gem, and I think every aspiring psychologist should have a copy on their shelf. Thank you.
Coming up on today's episode of the podcast, I am talking to Dr. Juliet Young about ways that we can be more creative in the work that we do with our clients and service users. We're also talking about how she got into psychology and what her experiences were like of doing her training during the pandemic. She also offers us her top tips for reducing burnout as an aspiring psychologist. Hope you find this episode so useful. Welcome along to the Aspiring Psychologist podcast. I am Dr. Marianne Trent and I'm a qualified clinical psychologist. I love being able to introduce you to the backstories of people you may already have heard of or you may already follow on social media. And today's guest might well be one of those people because she does wonderful illustrations all about mental health and working as a psychologist. We are talking to Dr. Juliet Young, also known as Creative Clinical Psychologist. You will get to learn the backstory of how she ended up in psychology and also one of the other professional psychology disciplines that she considered before becoming a clinical psychologist. Let's dive in and hear all about it, and I'll catch you on the other side. Hi, just want to welcome along Dr. Juliet Young to the podcast, who is a qualified clinical psychologist and also a really creative clinical psychologist too. Hi, Juliet.
Hiya.
So we first crossed paths because somebody had said they'd love to see us talk to one another. And that was over on Twitter /X, whatever it is these days. Before we get into you and your fantastically creative illustration ways, can we have a little bit of a think about you and psychology?
Yeah, sure.
So how did your...
What would you like to know?
Everything. When did you first take an interest in psychology and how did that unfold for you?
When I was back in secondary school, actually, I wasn't very well behaved in secondary school and I would often be sent to the head teacher's office or the deputy head's office. And I had been watching Tanya Byron's Little Angels. I don't know whether people will remember that or whether aspiring psychologists are old enough to remember that, but it was a TV show that... A psychologist went in and helped parents to think about their children's behaviour through a kind of needs-based lens. So I was really fascinated by that and interested. And then in school, when I would be sent to the teacher's office, I would kind of bring in this, well, they need to be doing this better, they need to be thinking about this. The deputy head teacher at the time said to me, Juliet, you should be an educational psychologist. And of course, I didn't know what that meant, but that sort of stuck with me. So I guess that's kind of where it began.
I love that. They didn't just see you as being precocious and put you back in their box. They thought, she's kind of good at this. We should probably help her cultivate this.
Yeah.
Nice. So then presumably you went off to university to study psychology.
Yes. So I did a BTEC at college. I didn't do the normal route of A-levels. And within that was a kind of a module on psychology. And that's where I fell in love with it. And then after a year out, decided that actually I did want to go to university. And then, applied and got on. Studied at UWE to do my undergraduate.
Great. And did you then fall in love with clinical psychology during your undergrad degree, or did that come later?
No, so I had no idea what clinical psychology was, probably until, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, actually. So that would have been, I started that 16 years ago. So there's a big chunk where I didn't know what clinical psychology was. And it wasn't until I knew what educational psychology was because my teacher had mentioned it. And I got a job after my undergrads working in like an eating disorder, a home for people with eating disorders, really. And decided through that I really did want to pursue a career in educational psychology. So I went and got a job in a school and then worked there for 6 months, went and got a job in another school, worked there for 5 years. And within that time applied for educational psychology and I didn't get on. And actually within that process, so it was about the same time as I read a book called by Dr. Tanya Byron, A Skeleton Cupboard. Or what that book does is it gives, I think it's 4 case studies and talks about these people and their difficulties and really it sort of formulates. And that really captured me and really made me think, actually, maybe I really like this idea of formulation and thinking about people's needs. So I then decided that I needed to get a job within the NHS and get some experience in mental health services. So I got a job working on crisis teams, they're known as in Bristol, and intensive teams, they're also called in the broader trust that I work in, and just doing bank shifts. So adult mental health services. And then also decided I wanted to do a master's to just try and get my head into clinical psychology. So I ended up, there's a bit of a long story behind this, but I ended up going to the University of East London to study clinical and community psychology. Now, when I applied for this, I kind of went on it because I was really captured by community psychology and what the course outline was, without really realizing that how far east the University of East London is from Bristol. And I would get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, get on a coach, get to central London, go for a day of lectures, and then do the same return journey. So I did that for a year, well, not quite a year, I think it was sort of 8 months once a week. And then alongside that, and while doing the crisis work, also got a job as my first job as an assistant psychologist.
Lovely. Gosh, yeah, that is quite the commute, isn't it? And then you only need one decent train strike or delay and it just sends your whole day into chaos.
Yeah, I think there was a time when I think it was the Beast from the East. I don't know whether you remember that, when there was that huge few days of snow, and I ended up getting on a coach and going to London for all the lectures to be cancelled, and then being stuck in London, having to stay at a friend's house.
Oh, gosh. But I think what nicely portraying is that actually as an aspiring psychologist, we can really spread ourselves very thinly, expecting ourselves to be in several places at the same time and, you know, trying to learn whilst also probably being quite stressed and pressured, and holding many different thoughts in our head and responsibilities. You know, it's not easy stuff, is it?
No, and I think you've got to want it, and I think you've got to. I guess it's about there's a lot of hard work that goes into building that portfolio, is it, I guess, of experiences. And but I also think there's something about values, and for me, like going and doing the master's in UEL, like that was, I was so inspired by the lectures, especially the ones around community psychology, and we had a term of doing critical psychology as well, that it didn't feel exhausting or hard. I felt very energized by it. I felt very inspired, and I felt very I guess it really confirmed to me that I wanted to work in clinical psychology. because I could do those things that I kind of saw as educational psychology, like working with a wider system, thinking in a kind of more systemic way, but also, but also meeting those needs of kind of wanting to be able to do therapy. And I guess it's working across those systems, like Bronfenbrenner's ecological systems theory. I'm going off on a tangent,
that's
but yes,
right.
It's really hard. It's really hard, I think. I think I was very fortunate to have had quite a lot of experience behind me at the point I decided I wanted to go into that. So that kind of acted as a bit of a platform to get my job as an assistant psychologist and to, you know, get onto the master's course and to be able to be working in a kind of a flexible job doing crisis work to enable me to fund my master's and to be able to fund, you know, my rent and stuff like that as well. So it's tough.
Yeah. One of the themes in the Clinical Psychologist Collective book was this perseverance, and that you really need it, because otherwise at any point you could be like, oh, I'm just gonna not bother, I'm gonna go and do something else. Whereas, you know, the more and more you persevere, the more and more likely you are to actually get to where you need to be, to get on the doctorate, to get qualified. It's a lot. Mm. It is a lot. And I remember, as I was listening to you speak, it was reminding me of when I was doing my master's and I was working full time whilst studying a master's part time, whilst I'd also had a car accident, I had back problems, I'd just broken up with a partner as well. There could not have been any more going on in my life. And yet it was that year that I did my successful form to get on to the doctorate. You know, it's like someone might have said to me at any point, oh, why don't you just not apply this year? Like, would never have been a question that I wasn't going to apply that year, you know? Anytime I wasn't osteo or physio or crying about my... I was working on my form. Like, there was never a chance I wasn't going to do it. And actually, I did get on that year, and it the back's fine now. The back was fine by the time I started training. But it's that continual motion, isn't it? You have to want it, you know. And I guess the support systems around you have to be good enough that you don't burn out.
Yeah, and I think you have to want it, and I think it's also okay to take a break from it. I didn't. I was very driven, but I had also had sort of taken a break from it in that I'd had that. You know, I'd had several years where I just enjoyed working and enjoyed my job working in a school. And I had it in my head that I wanted to be an educational psychologist, but I also really focused on just enjoying my job and growing myself within that. So I guess it's about maintaining that drive, but also there's not a time pressure. I think a lot of aspiring psychologists I've spoken to feel like there's this real urgency to get on, and I completely understand it, because if you want something, you want it to be, you know, happening, and if there's a risk it might not happen, you really, you know, you want is that uncertainty and sitting with that uncertainty. But what I always say is that actually that time before training was probably some of the best part of my career so far, in that I had a lot more freedom before, you know, once you're qualified, there's a lot more responsibilities and a lot more, things that you have to do, that actually when you're an assistant, or when I was working in the job in the school, that, yeah, you have this sort of freedom. And yeah, I would always say to people, like, training is just one part of your journey. And like, you've got your entire, you know, working life, and to really think about that actually it's okay just to enjoy what you're doing. And obviously there's financial implications, like it's really difficult to be. Yeah. And that's it's probably even more so at the moment with the cost of living crisis, but it's really difficult to be on a very low paid job. And I was when I worked in the school, and assistant psychologists don't get paid amazingly. So I'm saying that, but I also, I guess, recognizing that there is a financial pressure on people to be able to qualify. I think that's really difficult, isn't it? And other people will have, more difficult financial situations and other factors which put pressure on that, like having children and, yeah.
Absolutely. And thank you for that really nice, compassionate reframe, because you're right. There is no, sometimes people say to me, oh, you know, I really need to be qualified by the time I'm 30. And it's like, well, why? You know, you could still, you know, live your life whilst you're training if you want to. You know, you can have a family whilst you're on the course if you want to. You can flex it to look how you want it to look. And when I graduated from my undergrad, I went around the world traveling for 6 months. And had I not had those experiences and the experiences of saving up to go traveling, and then the experiences of having an absolute ball with my friends and assistant psychologist, I love it when the Facebook memories come up of that time. You know, that all helped with my resilience and with my, you know, not burning out and with just having fun along the way, so that it wasn't just about psychology. You absolutely need more in the background, don't you?
Yeah, you have to, you know, your life comes first, psychology doesn't come first. And yes, we do, you know, we live in a society which means that our communities don't tend to hold us, so we do have to get a job and we do have to be able to fund our lifestyle most of the time, or most people tend to need that. But your life, you know, you've got to prioritize that, because, yeah, it's really important, isn't it? It's who you are. It's what gives you your nourishment. And, yeah, I think that is, yeah, or one part of what gives you your nourishment.
Yeah, I totally agree. So what year did you start training as a clinical psychologist then?
So I started 2019. So started 4 years ago, been qualified a year.
Amazing. And how has that journey been for you, transitioning from trainee to qualified?
I think it's been generally a good one. I think that training was very challenging because the pandemic hit 6 months into training, and there were lots of challenges that came with that in terms of placements. I mean, it gave us more time to be at home because we didn't have to travel to lectures because lectures are online, but I wonder the impact of that on how much, you know, information I retain from lectures, just sat staring at a screen. And my placements were tricky because a lot of them were remote. I don't work very well remotely. I like being somewhere, I like being among people. That's kind of how I work best. So I would say that I probably haven't got a comparative experience other than people who trained at, you know, a similar time or through the pandemic. But I really enjoyed qualifying and being able to just be in the office more and to go into a job that I loved, and not that I didn't enjoy some of my placements, but there were some, you know, there were some real highlights in some of my placements. But ultimately where I'm working now is the area that I want to be in, and therefore it's very values based and it meets that need to, you know, to be working with my values and with my interests. And I think so I think an easy transition. I would say I was definitely ready to qualify. I was definitely ready to, you know, to get out into the world. And, you know, that's not to say that training wasn't really important. There's lots of gaps that I probably still need to fill, and learning is an ongoing journey, isn't it? So I don't mean it in the way that, oh yeah, I'm, you know, I just knew everything and I needed to leave, but in that I was ready to go and start the next stage.
Yeah. And I guess as I hear you talk, I guess I'm wondering if there's a niche in the market for doing some research into whether the pandemic cohorts have actually had a more autonomous experience, that it's felt, I don't know, somehow less protected, or that you're kind of having to just do more self-directed stuff and having to really force yourself to concentrate and focus, as we know happens when we're trying to Zoom learn. You know, there's always other things going on, whereas if you're in the room, if you've got your cohort there, you have to show up, you have to be concentrating as much as you can.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, it'd be really interesting for someone to look into that. And I also think that there's room for one thing that I think clinical psychology doesn't have is kind of like a yearly refresher, or like a 2 yearly refresher where you have to go back and do some of those things and think about those skills and gaps, or I don't know. And I guess that might not work if you're in a very specialist area, but having the opportunity to be able to refresh, I think would mop up some of those gaps, which, yeah, I think during the pandemic it was just really hard to learn and to stay engaged, and you're not having that contact with others other than on the WhatsApp group. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have a very good friend who lives on the road next to me, but other than that, there's not that contact time. And I think that's a really vital part of training, actually, is learning from your peers. And I feel like I missed out on a lot of that.
It really is. But I think also the training is as much about instilling your confidence in yourself as it is teaching you the stuff. So I remember I was actually unwell for the half a day on the training for how to work with people with a bipolar presentation. Half a day for that. That ended up being kind of quite a key part of my qualified life, is working with people within that disorder. And I still sometimes wonder, like, would I be better at this if I'd had that half a day training? And of course we know the answer is no, because what can you possibly hope to learn about a whole kind of way of working with people and understanding and conceptualizing difficulties in half a day? You just can't, you know.
I think that's really true. And actually, you know, what's the saying? Jack of all trades, master of none. That you come out of training with these tiny pockets of things. So yeah, it probably actually is that there is. I wouldn't have retained all of that stuff, whether I was doing it online or not. But I definitely think, yeah, I identify with that as well. I missed the ACT training for our CAMS, so CAMS or acceptance and commitment therapy for CAMS, and then also for the adult. And I missed both of them. I was ill for one, I had a funeral for the other. And I just didn't have time to catch up on the lecture notes. I think I probably had a look at them, but it's not the same as being in a lecture. And all the time now, because ACT is something that I think I really identify with values and thinking, you know, in the work I'm doing around with young people with their asylum claim, there's, you know, as we're going along, there's not much we can do about the process, which is a very long process. So it's helping them think about, you know, accepting the situation they're in and what can they do within that to, I guess, find pockets of happiness through meeting their values or whatever. So I have a kind of loose idea of what ACT is, but I don't feel like I fully understand it. And I feel like that's a big gap that I need to go and revise, and I'd missed during training.
I'd say there's always time, and, you know, even now I'm experiencing and, you know, enjoying learning about new topics and new areas. I love an audiobook, and so that's a really nice way for me to learn things. You know, you are fairly newly qualified, and you can just give yourself time to bed into being qualified and just, yeah, turn to more, you know, learning and enhancing your learning needs as and when the time is ready, I would say. So you've told us really nicely a little bit about some of the qualified work you do there. I think do you work a split post, am I right in saying?
Yeah. So in teams that are sort of attached to each other, but yeah, two different distinct roles, both clinical psychology roles.
Brilliant.
Do you want me to say a bit more?
Are you happy to say a little bit more? You don't have to identify the service you work in or anything, but are you happy to say a little bit more?
Yeah. So 2 days a week I work in a service for children in foster care, and that is mainly working with the systems around young people, although I have got a few young people that I see weekly for therapy sessions. And that's where I worked as an assistant psychologist as well. So it was sort of like coming home. And I really love that work. I really like the complexity. I like working with systems. I like thinking about attachment and trauma. I'm really interested in kind of developmental trauma and the impact of that, and how that can be, some of that can be repaired. So that's the 2 days a week. And then 2.5 days a week, I work a 9-day fortnight. 2.5 days a week is in the asylum seeker and refugee clinic. And that is working with children seeking asylum, families as well. It's primarily a trauma service, so we've got quite a narrow commissioning in that it is just, you know, working around post-traumatic stress, and but that is prevalent in that population, because most people who have had to leave their country of origin have experienced, you know, horrific trauma, either when they were there or on their journey. So a lot of our children meet our criteria anyway.
I once did a very specialist piece of work linked to a GP who specialised in supporting asylum seekers and refugees, and it was just, I learned so much about being human and humble and really, I guess, really, like you said, boiling down those core values of what's important to me, what's important to them, and how we can kind of try and help people find some sort of stability in a world that feels like it's just swirling and ever changing. Really tricky stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a really, it's really, yeah, it's, I think that's really kind of hit the nail on the head in the kind of the swirling, got an image in my mind of this, yeah, the kind of swirling stuff around them. And I, as an example, I did an assessment last week and I drew out Bronfenbrenner's ecological systems theory and kind of talked about as a way of validating, like, I know all of this stuff is, you know, going on in your country of origin, and the impact of seeing that on social media. I know that your asylum claim is really causing you lots of stress. I know that things within the system around you are really stressful. And unfortunately, we, you know, I might be able to write a letter to the solicitor to give them a nudge to, you know, give you some more information. I might be able to do some drawings to try and make a shift in the wider system, even if it's a very minute shift. But ultimately, we're restricted to working, you know, with you and with just within the individual. And I think that's, yeah, I think it's really hard for people to get, and understandably so, because actually if your mental health and well-being is being impacted, or if the main difficulty for you are these other things going on in your life, and somebody is sitting down in a room with you to do therapy, and you're like, well, that's not what I need. I need that other stuff to change. And so it's, I think it's, yeah, it's an interesting job to be in, because actually a lot of the time you're working within systems which are making people more unhappy, more stressed. They're exacerbating some of their symptoms. Like, it's a real challenge to do that. And sometimes I really question when people are like, this isn't going to be, why would doing some, you know, breathing exercises and you know, muscle relaxation, that's not going to change the fact that I've got an asylum claim hanging over me, which might send me back to a country where I'm killed. And it's sort of, you know, it's very, you've got to be very careful, I think, to make sure that you're validating alongside what you're offering.
Yeah, validation was absolutely the word that I was thinking of, but also just extending some compassion, and sometimes just being seen for where you're at right now and having a space to kind of explore how that feels can be wonderfully transformative.
Yeah, I think relationships, and if I sort of look through the lenses, the attachment lenses that in my other role and apply them within the role with asylum seeking children is thinking about actually safe relationships. And, you know, I think it's the trauma recovery model that actually the bottom of it is safe relationships, therapeutic relationships. And I think that, yeah, if I can offer that space, even if we don't do the trauma work that we're kind of there to do, it's giving somebody an experience of somebody who is safe and containing and listening. And in a world that's very hostile, you know, yeah, just the context, which is very hostile if you're a young asylum seeker, especially if you're unaccompanied arriving in the UK, then that is, you know, that's somebody who's giving something that is the opposite to hostile. And I guess somewhere along the line will give you a sense of safety in the world, even if it's a very small one.
Absolutely. And I find myself kind of drawing comparisons between foster care systems. So when I work with people in the asylum seeking role, people contacted me kind of years later to say, you know, thanks. And actually that made a real difference. And just being able to hear your voice at times that felt really challenging and being able to draw upon some of the stuff we'd done actually really did make a difference. And it's knowing that you can still check back in, you know, if they want to. So we don't kind of lead that ourselves. But I don't know, maybe years down the line, people will come back to you and say, gosh, that was really incredibly powerful. And I think that's a really nice thing, that you get to be part of someone else's story, even though you may never know that you're still being held in mind. It's a real magical thing we do, I think.
Yeah, it's a real privilege, I think, isn't it? to be in that position. And yeah, to be able to have that sort of impact on people's lives and to be with them. And a lot of the trauma work I do, it's such an honour for people to share their story with me. Like it really is like an amazing honour to hear and witness, you know, their story and some of the really awful things that they've never shared with anyone since they've arrived in the UK, other than maybe on their, you know, in a very formal way in their application, but in, you know, thinking about the emotional impact, thinking about, yeah, but I guess being alongside them in an emotional way in sharing that is a deep privilege. Like it really is, like, yeah, I'm very lucky to have that, really.
Yeah, and that the ability to be able to kind of help them de-shame that process as well is, you know, amazing. So important. So tell us a little bit then about your wonderful illustrations and how you started to weave that into your clinical work with people.
Well, I guess, I mean, I've always drawn and illustrated, you know, my whole life, really. So it's so it's sort of a natural thing to bring it into my work. And when, you know, when I worked in the school, I would be doing sessions with young people and I would be drawing to try and help, you know, think about ideas and to, it often takes the focus off that kind of dyad, doesn't it? It takes a different focal point and enables conversation. And so I think I probably bring it into my clinical, or have been bringing it into my clinical work for a long time. I guess that when it kind of ended up getting, like, publicly coming into view, is that what you mean? Like, how did it kind of evolve? Or do you mean, yeah. So I guess, I mean, I just bought a tablet in the pandemic about 3 years ago, and thought I would share some drawings on various concepts and yeah, just gave it a go and yeah, it just became really popular. And it still sort of surprises me now that everyone likes my drawings so much. And I think I put one yesterday that was about compassionate leadership, and it's, you know, sort of 1,000 people have liked it, and there's lots of shares and lots of comments in it, and I think that it, yeah, the feedback I've had is that people find it really useful to use in their clinical work to kind of distill ideas down into a visual concept, and that can be really useful, you know, because there's lots of really complex concepts in psychology, aren't there? And we live in an increasingly visual world. So, yeah, so that's kind of what I hope to do. That's sort of what's ended up happening. And it's ended up, you know, I do various other, there's been various offshoots from it now, which I really enjoy. So
I did, yeah, see the one you mentioned. I think it was like, it was almost like a waterfall. Like, was that like a rainbowy, yeah, waterfall? It was really, really nice. Really nice. And I'm just in awe of you because I'm just not very good at art. I have these wonderful ideas in my head and then that doesn't come out of my pen. Like it doesn't translate. But you do yours on a tablet, do you? So is that how, like, are you like an Apple Pen kind of girl? How does it work practically?
I don't have an iPad. I've got a Samsung. I always get messages saying, what do you do these on? And people often think that it's on an app actually, and there's like a clip art image and I'm just bringing them together, but it's all hand drawn. So I've got an app called Ibis, which is, I don't think it's like a well-known one at all, but it's just what I started using and now I'm most familiar with. And yeah, I'll just draw them and it can take, sometimes they can be very quick. Sometimes it can take me hours and hours and hours. And I really enjoy, you know, I really enjoy doing it. It's very therapeutic for me to sit down and draw and just have the creativity or the time to be able to be creative, actually the freedom to be able to kind of create. And I think in pictures. So I often, you know, I think in, like, I see concepts and I kind of am visualizing all the time things. So it's just kind of, yeah, putting that then gets translated into, yeah, drawing it. And sometimes they're not that good either. People sort of say, oh, like, I quite like your scruffy little drawings. Like, I just think that sometimes there's like a wonky arm and it, like, kind of, it doesn't all come together. But, and there's some that I've done which I sort of look at and just think that's awful. But yeah, there's yeah, that's just sort of how it comes together, really.
I like that I think life is imperfect, isn't it? And sometimes it doesn't need to be pristine and polished. And I'm sure it's still, even your scruffy ones that you don't like are still far above what I could achieve. How did you start to think about putting your ideas down into a book? How did that come about?
So I was contacted actually by an editor from Jessica Kingsley Publishers, and she just contacted me saying, I really like your drawings. I like how you sort of distill concepts down and your explanations as well. Like, would you be interested in doing a book in like maybe kind of I think she suggested maybe a clinical psychology one or CBT or sort of an area. And I was honoured when she emailed me that, because I just thought that's, you know, what a privilege for somebody to be thinking about, offering you that opportunity. And yeah, and then that formed into, I actually contacted two of my lecturers, because I thought, if I'm going to do an illustrated guide to clinical psychology, lecturers who teach on courses about clinical psychology are the best place to go. And I contacted one who's very, not very actually, that's probably unfair, but she's a qualified CBT therapist, and I guess kind of gives that more CBT lens. And then I also contacted my research supervisor at the time, who I guess took more of a critical lens towards clinical psychology and some of those more community psychology values. And then we all got together and then created the proposal, and then that got accepted. And then April this year, it was like a second thesis, trying to finish it off and trying to finish off the illustrations and stuff.
Amazing. So we're recording this at the tail end of 2023, but we're very much planning that this episode's going to come out when your book is available. So tell us what it's called. Tell us where you're imagining it might be available for purchase. Tell us all of those good things.
So it's called An Illustrated Guide to Clinical Psychology. And yeah, it's by myself, Juliet Young, and then Dr. Catherine Butler, Dr. Rachel Pascal. And it's going to be available on Amazon. I think it's already available for sort of pre-sale and major bookshops. We're also doing a book launch, which I think maybe on, I think it's the 27th, 28th in Bath. So if you're in Bath, but there'll be information about that on my Instagram page and on my Twitter page closer to the time around that.
Brilliant. How exciting. Your very own book launch. What an exciting book baby to be launching on the world.
Yeah.
So your ideal client for that is an aspiring psychologist. Is that the ICA?
Yeah, so aspiring psychologists. We also talked about it just being useful for newly qualified psychologists, and also those who might be working alongside clinical psychologists and wanting to understand what it is as a profession, you know, to have in a staff room where there's a multidisciplinary team. And just, I guess it could be a reference book for, you know, I might find it useful to reference for another section someone else has written on, I don't know, cognitive analytic therapy, and just to remind myself what the key principles. It's very much an intro and summary. So there's, you know, a page or two per idea, per therapy modality, per approach. There's stuff around the first chapter's on kind of the history and some context, and there's stuff around key skills. So it's a pick up, flick, and you know, put down, or you know, or you might want to read it back to front, but it's sort of for anybody that it might be useful to, really.
It sounds brilliant. Have you designed your cover as well? I'm imagining it's brilliantly illustrated.
Yes. So the cover was I gave the illustrations, and it's been put together by a graphic designer, actually, because that's not one of my strengths, or at least something I've not tried before, is the kind of the composing things in a graphic design way. So,
and have you seen it yet? Have you held it in your hands as yet?
Not a physical copy. We had the final proof, just PDF sent through the other day, which is sort of bizarre to see, you know, that it's ISB numbers, or the, you know, and we've had some endorsers who have read it and given some comments on it, and it feels it's just really exciting. Like I remember sitting down with one of the other trainees a year into training and sort of talking about wanting to take it a bit easy on training and saying, oh, it's not like we're going to write a book or anything. And then here I am, 4 years later with my book coming out in a few months. It just, yeah,
I love that. And
very exciting.
if people want to learn more about you or follow you on socials, where should they head, Juliet?
So Instagram's probably the best place. So I'm creative.clinical.psychologist. I've recently set up an Instagram for sort of my like Dr. Juliet Young.
Brilliant. Thank you. I'll make sure there's details in the show notes for how people can follow you. There will also be details in the show notes of how you can buy Juliet's book as well, which is available now as we are looking at future March 2024. So, thank you so much for your time. Wishing you the absolute best of luck with your first book baby. I hope it flies really well for you and really makes a difference and helps people understand what it is that we do and perhaps feel a bit more contained and understood by those around us as well.
I hope so.
And you've given us lots of lovely advice to reduce burnout along the way in clinical psychology as well. So thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you for sharing your time with us too.
Well, thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed talking to you today, Marianne.
Oh, thank you. Likewise. How incredible. Please do go and follow Juliet over on Instagram, Creative Clinical Psychologist. And her book is available now. So check out the details in the show notes, or if you look on my socials, you'll be able to see links to the book as well. Hope you found that interesting. I love the way that psychology allows us to blend our skills, our interests, and our passions into our clinical work. I'd love to know what you think to this episode. Come and let me know over in the free Facebook group, the Aspiring Psychologist Community with Dr. Marianne Trent. Please do also subscribe and like if you're watching on YouTube. And why not consider checking out the Aspiring Psychologist membership, as well as my own books, the Aspiring Psychologist Collective and the Clinical Psychologist Collective book. Thank you so much for being part of my world, and I will look forward to catching up with you for the next episode of the podcast, which will be available from 6 a.m. on Monday. Take care.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast. Dr. Marianne Trent.
My name's Yana, and I'm a trainee psychological wellbeing practitioner. I read the Clinical Psychologist Collective book. I found it really interesting about all the different stories and how people got to become a clinical psychologist. It just amazed me how many different routes there are to get there, and there's no perfect way to become one. And this kind of filled me with confidence that no, I'm not doing it wrong, and put less pressure on myself. So if you're feeling a bit uneasy about becoming a clinical psychologist, I'd definitely recommend this just to put yourself at ease, and everything will be okay. But trust me, you will not put the book down once you start.